think he gave me a bigger dose because I woke up in the middle of the surgery.
What?
I woke up and I'm looking around and they're doing the surgery.
No way.
I'm looking in there's TV screens around the room and I'm watching them. You know, they're on the phone, they're trying to detach this, it's like a spring or a coil that they put up in through the hole. It attaches to one side of the wall of the heart.
Yeah.
They pull the other side through and it sort of clamps it together. They were having issues detaching the catheter from this thing that they put in my heart. So they're on the phone to someone else. We can't get it. The guy's like, just yank it. And I can't feel it. I can't feel a thing. And they got it. They detached it. And then I just got myself off the surgical table myself onto the bed and they wheeled me out.
No way. That is crazy. When you wake up, do they know that you'd woken up and they're talking to you? Or?
From the local parks of Sydney to the Croatian National League, Tommy Romic's journey is one of grit, discipline and resilience. As a goalkeeper, he built a reputation for commanding presence and fearless leadership. As a professional boxer, he tested his courage and mental toughness in the ring. And after a life-threatening stroke in 2024, he chose not to slow down, but to build something bigger, the Top Flight Goalkeeper Academy, where he now shapes the next generation of goalkeepers. In this episode, Tommy shares powerful lessons on respect, discipline, self-belief, and overcoming adversity. His story isn't just about football or boxing. It's about courage in the face of setbacks, commitment to growth, and passing on wisdom that he wished he'd had as a young player. Whether you're a growth-driven man who loves sport, a coach guiding young athletes, or a parent supporting your kids on their sporting journey, this conversation offers insights that will help you rise, defend, and dominate in sport and life. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport as I see it is to see your vision become a reality. Find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. Hey, Tommy, how you going?
Good, mate. How are you?
Really good. There's a real Australian football name, yours, Tommy Romic.
Yeah.
Croatian heritage. And Australia has a long and vast background in quality, international players, but also club players from that Croatian background. It must be something you're really proud of.
I am. We come from a small nation. If you look back, you know, in those golden years of the Socceroos,
yeah.
I'd say half of those Socceroos were from a Croatian background. You look at our Croatian national team, the success we've had there since we've become established as our own nation in 96. It's unbelievable. Not just in football, in all sports, we've been quite successful. So very proud.
Yeah, and even that 2006 team for Australia, we played against a Croatian team that had a few men who had grown up in Australia too, right?
Yeah, that's right. Joe Šimunić.
Yeah.
I think even Joey Didelica was in that Croatian squad. So,
Amazing. So we know Australia's background in football in having those teams from an ethnic background. What are your memories of those days? Did you grow up going to watch Sydney United play? Or would have even been called Sydney Croatia back then?
No, it was Sydney Croatia back then.
Yeah.
I remember being a ball boy, you know, seeing the likes of Tani Popovic, Željko Kalats. I used to look up to him. You know, Ante Milicic, you know, all those guys, you know, you'd have packed stadiums, 12,000 people packed in that.
And the best food at those grounds, anywhere at a sporting field, anywhere, right?
Yeah, chalapa rolls were always a hit. I think they still are today.
Yeah, nice. I'm sure plenty of other backgrounds would lay claim to it, but it's a pretty impressive standard that's been hit by the people from Croatian heritage in Australian football, for sure. So did you grow up then, that was something you just wanted to do or only wanted to do, is like play football?
So I started playing when I was 3 years old.
Yeah.
Funny story, my dad, we had swings in our backyard, and they were our goals, and my dad used to kick the ball at me, and I used to start diving around. That's how I became a keeper. Yeah. So I started playing sort of under sixes when I was 5, played for a local team, and then I went across to Sydney United. I was playing as a 9s as a 6-year-old. A lot different back then. Yeah, playing under 9s in a full field, full-size goals, which I think is better for development, which is why I only train my goalkeepers in a full-size goal. Doesn't matter how old you are, you're training in a full-size goal.
Oh, okay, let's go in there straight away. Why do you think that's important for their development as goalkeepers?
Well, I feel that when you go from under 12s in a set program, smaller goals, and you jump into those big 7.4-meter, 2.4-high goals, it's a shock. It's a shock, and it takes time to adjust and, you're not expected to cover the whole goal. But if you're at least training in that size goal for a couple of years prior to sort of entering that youth stage, it's not a shock, it's not a intimidating as it would be if you're just jumping straight in. So I've got 10-year-old goalkeepers that cover full size goal.
Yeah, that's really cool. I think it comes back to something that's a bit of a problem in, well, probably all youth sport, but particularly football, is managing expectations. Like, I think one of the reasons may be because of how many teams have got themselves so consumed with winning that you know, we've got to make it smaller, and, you know, these poor goalkeepers, and but really what we should be doing is, as you say, is making decisions based on the best development as a child and putting education around that, right?
Well, if you look at back 10 years ago in the goalkeeper space in Australian football, you'd have at least 10 to 12 goalkeepers playing at the highest level in top leagues around the world that are up for selection for the Socceroos. You're lucky to get 4 now. Our captain, Matty Ryan, he's struggling to get game time, which is why he's constantly looking for a club. You know, and there's no one really pushing. So there's a big problem in that space at the moment. And which is sort of why I came back into the game after I stepped away for a few years, because I saw there was a big problem in that space.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I even just look at how the whole system's organised, and I certainly think it's an improvement on where we were before, but like everyone's encouraged to play a whole lot of different positions. So what we're ending up with, from my experience, is we're ending up with a lack of keepers and a lack of nines right across the park, because they all sort of fit into this system that can kind of play anywhere. Whereas sometimes those, like, people would naturally incline to those positions, right? Like goalkeeper is one of those things where, as you said, you just started doing it from a young age. Well, if you'd got put into a system where you had to play every position, that might have actually been taken away from you to a certain degree.
Well, that's right. So I think the problem that speak to most coaches about, especially in the JDL system now, that you get to under nines and there's no goalkeepers. You're struggling to find a goalkeeper for under nines, under tens. You're putting players in to fill that space. Whereas when I grew up, fives, under sixes, you've got goalkeepers. You're playing in that, what they play in now in the JDL system, you're playing in that under fives, under sixes, up to under nines, where you move into a full-size goal. So I think the development is delayed because you don't have the goalkeeper for the first few years, and then trying to find a kid who wants to jump in goals is hard.
Really interesting. I don't know if you've seen much of John O'Sullivan's work. Oh, actually, not John O'Sullivan, Tom Beyer. And he talks about how important it is to start learning those skills because of the cognitive development from the ages of two. Now, people say, oh, skill development's from, this age. But no, it's like we've got to be starting early. And you're a prime example. And I'm sure if we asked a lot of those keepers that you talked about, Zelko and all of the keepers, Bozza, I'm sure they were doing similar to what you described from a very young age.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've got young kids and I don't push them into football, but I get a ball. My youngest is 18 months. I throw it at him just so he gets that used to that catching the ball and throwing it back. You got to start development from a young age, but in a way where you're not forcing it upon them. They want to do it themselves.
More likely they've got a device in their hand, unfortunately. I think it's not just football, but just skills. Like I watch youngsters now try and throw and catch, and the throwing and catching, just of like a tennis ball or a cricket ball, is nowhere near what it was 20 years ago because that was just
No.
something that you did. You threw a ball around just for fun. I mean,
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the answer is, but there's definitely we can see now in hindsight there's a whole lot of gaps. Well, we're definitely going to talk about goalkeeping, but I didn't want to just talk about goalkeeping today.
Yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit about your journey. But what I'm most fascinated about is the journey you've had since the setback you had in was it only last year.
Yeah.
Mate, when we met and you were talking me through that whole situation, I was like, I just remember like having my mind blown. So in 2024, is that when it was? Like, did you
Yeah,
just start to
March.
get? Yeah, I think you said, was it your
It
wife that
was
recognised maybe something's not quite right?
so what happened was I was supposed to go to work that day and I took my kids to school and I didn't even feel sick. Took
Yeah,
them to
right.
school. I'm not gonna go today. I was supposed to go 2 hours down south. I came home and started talking to my wife and I go, I've got a head spin and I grabbed my head and it felt like someone's just hit me with a bat straight across the head. And I remember it so vividly like it's happening now. I look down at my arm and in slow motion I can see the drool falling from my mouth and splashing up off my hand.
Wow.
And I lost my speech. And my wife straight away, she goes, "You're having a stroke." And I was like Frankenstein. I couldn't say anything. And so she called the ambulance. And at first, I was like telling her, "I'm trying to say I'm not going to the hospital because I'm stubborn." And so I eventually went to the hospital. Ambulance came and grabbed me, and I did all the tests, arteries all clear, everything's clear. Did the MRI, yep, you got a stroke, hit the left side of my brain in the dictionary part, which is why I lost my speech. But I was lucky. I started to get my speech back, and for a while I was very confused.
This is all in this initial stage still.
Yeah. So I started to get my speech back, but I couldn't. I was mumbling words, and it was really strange. Then they tested my heart, and they found I had a hole in my heart that I was born with it.
Wow.
It's quite big, quite a big hole, and I've had it my whole life. And essentially what they said was, this could have happened to you at any point in your life. And I played soccer professionally. When I retired, I went to professional boxing. So my training was intense. So I'm very lucky to still be here.
Amazing. Even the fact that, like, you went home and that your wife was there, because that could have happened anywhere.
I could have been on the road.
Yeah, with the kids.
I could have been driving down south.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm.
So I am very fortunate, and I think I was very angry for a long time after that.
Yeah. Why me?
It was definitely why me.
Yeah.
It was definitely why me, and I sort of, after that, all I could really do was sleep. I don't think for the first 3 or 4 weeks I was awake more than 2 hours at a time. Very fatigued, and eventually I sort of started thinking, and I already sort of was thinking about starting an academy prior to that happening. I was working in the construction industry, and it was tough, because you're always chasing people for money, and very stressful, and it became very, very hard. And I believe now, thinking, post everything that had happened, I had heart surgery, and I think it was a sign that I had to move in a different direction with my life. But it took a while for me to comprehend that and come to terms with, looking at it with that positive mindset that could push me forward and inspire me to do something that I'm passionate about.
Mm. It's often the case, unfortunately, that people need to sort of go into some dark places before they realize, I've been thinking about this for so long, but you're almost facing immortality, right?
Well, that's the thing, right? And from all of that, I was very scarred, and I did hit rock bottom, and I didn't want to do anything, and I didn't want to be around people. It was hard, but you got to think, there's a way out of it. When you hit the bottom, there's only one way to go, right? There's only up.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to find that right mindset to go into that direction.
Yeah. Have you? I imagine you have spoken to your wife and to your family. Like, how did they see the whole situation? Were they like, well, we know it's going to be okay, or were they freaking out, or what was sort of going on for them?
I think it was a very scary time, especially for my daughters. They were always worried to leave me alone, that something might happen. I think even today they sort of have that worry at the back of their head.
Yeah.
But, it's scary. I literally... I saw my life flash before my eyes, and that's being dead set. I saw within, a minute, might have been longer, might have been less, felt like a minute, but I saw my whole childhood growing up just flash before my eyes.
Wow.
It was so scary.
So in that in the moment, like when it first happened, were you, like you said, you couldn't speak, but were you coherent enough that you knew something wasn't right? Like, were you pretty scared, or were you so like out of it that it was kind of almost like out of body?
I knew something wasn't right, yeah. And I knew that I had a stroke. But me being me, I'm stubborn, and I didn't want to borrow a doctor or going to the hospital. Like, I'm not going to go and sit there for however many hours to get tests done, you know. But, you know, my wife got me into the ambulance, and off I went. And luckily for me, I got there quite quickly, because if I left it, I could be still in that same situation today.
What treatment do they have to give you? So they recognise the hole in the heart, but you're also the stroke. Like, what do they have to do to get everything back on track?
So I think if they said if I waited any longer, there's an injection they give to stroke patients.
Mm-hmm.
If it's within the right time frame, that can sort of reverse the symptoms. But they basically just pump me with blood thinners and aspirin and antibiotics and whatever else. I can't even remember.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I was okay.
Yeah, wow. Did you have to have heart surgery as well?
Yeah, I had heart surgery in June. That was just a keyhole heart surgery. Funny story, though. Just as I'm going into the surgery, when they have you in that room, I go, "You're going to put me out, yeah?" The cardiologist's like, "No, you're going to be awake." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "No, you're going to be awake." I said, no. Put me to sleep. So I think he's like, "Nah, you'll be right." I think he gave me a bigger dose because I woke up in the middle of the surgery.
What?
I woke up and I'm looking around and they're doing the surgery.
No,
I'm looking
way.
There's TV screens around the room and I'm watching them. Yeah, they're on the phone. They're trying to detach this. It's like a spring or a coil that they put up in through the hole. It attaches to one side of the wall of the heart.
Yeah.
They pull the other side through and it sort of clamps it together. They were having issues detaching the catheter from this thing that they put in my heart. So they're on the phone to someone else. We can't get it. The guy's like, "Just yank it." I'm like, "And I can't feel it. I can't feel a thing." And they got it. They detached it. And then I just got myself off the surgical table myself onto the bed and they wheeled me out.
No way. That is crazy. When you wake up, did they know that you'd woken up and they're talking to you?
No, they were talking amongst themselves. But I'll never forget it. It's like, wow, I woke up to it in the middle of my heart surgery. You know, so.
Oh, mate, unbelievable. So how long was recovery? So they obviously had to wait a while before they did heart surgery after the stroke. But then after that, what was the recovery like?
So I wasn't supposed to do anything for, I think, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. I went and played over 35 4 weeks later. And, yeah, I played probably 5 games for the rest of that year, made the grand final, and then that was it for me. I had a lot of pain in that groin area where they did the surgery from. But I had a fuse lit in me that I wanted to play again. And then I had to do it. I couldn't just sit around, and I needed something to get me out of the house.
I bet your wife loved that.
Yeah, well, I wasn't allowed to drive, so I had people pick me up and take me to the games, and so it's all a part of the journey.
Yeah, well, not having done it after heart surgery and a stroke, but I can definitely relate in terms of that, you know, doctors telling you you need to have a few weeks off, but you just play anyway because it's important, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Crazy. We'll come back to sort of the aftermath, but we want to go back now over some of your journey, because at a time where it was more common for young Australians to go over and ply their trade in Europe, you were one of those. You went and played in Croatia. What was that experience like? Did you go over with your family or did you go over on your own?
So I initially went when I was 15. And I went and I trialled at Hajduk Split. I was there for about a month. And, you know, there was an opportunity there, but I decided to go to another club that was in the same league, in the National League. And they wanted to sign me at this club at the age of 15 to be the number two for the first team.
Wow.
I was supposed to sit on the bench in the Europa League against Schalke in Germany.
Yeah.
And at the time, I had to get Croatian citizenship. I had to enroll into school. I had to have one of my uncles become a guardian because my parents had to come back. I had siblings here. So I did everything that Football Australia asked, and in the end, they go, "You're under 18. We're not giving you an international clearance."
What?
So
you were
sort of.
You were a big boy though, right?
Yeah.
At that age.
I was 15 years old. I was bigger than most, but.
Yeah.
My first game, I got to the club. Did us two training sessions, and then they had a friendly game because this was still in pre-season.
Yeah.
I went and played the friendly, played the first half, saved the penalty, kept the clean sheet.
How good.
They wanted to sign me straight away, you know, and the club tried to fight it for about, I don't know, I was there for about 5-6 months. And in the end, I decided to come back home, and That was a real kick in the guts. You know, I remember leaving Croatia, and I had a 6-hour layover in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I spent most of that time with a soccer ball in my hand, tears in my eyes, thinking, why did they not allow this?
Yeah.
You know?
So you come home and you've played a fair bit there, but did that knock you around a bit? Because, like, it doesn't sound like you got the same opportunities when you came back to Australia, which is, to me, doesn't make sense. But is that because there was a lot of high-quality keepers at the time?
So when I came back to Australia at that time, the next year I played, it was still the NSL back then.
Yeah.
So I played, I was selected for the New South Wales team.
Yep.
I was number one for New South Wales, and I was in the reserve grade NPL, not NPL, NSL youth team at 16. Yep. And, you know, I was training with Liam Reddy and Ivan Nasevsky, you know.
They were
the first grade keepers at the time. So you learn a lot of keepers like them, you know. And then I went back to Croatia when I was 18, almost 19, to the same club. They signed me, so I had an opportunity there. Obviously, I got there at the wrong time, as the club was going into liquidation. probably 6 months after I got there. But I got the experience playing against, you know, Luka Modric, Eduardo da Silva, you know, before they went on to play for Tottenham, Arsenal.
Yeah.
So it was a good experience. You know, and then I spent a couple of years in Croatia in the second and third division. And then I came back and I played park soccer because I sort of, I was like, my mind was boggled at, you know, how things could have turned out like that when, you know, I had everything in the palm of my hand. I played park soccer.
Was it, were you feeling a bit disillusioned, like, or ripped off, or what are you?
I felt ripped off. I felt ripped off, and I thought, you know, when I came back, I went and played park soccer. I started working, and I thought I was still for a bit of fun. But I can't do things just for a bit of fun. That's not how I'm wired. Yeah. You know? So the year after, I went and trialled for Macarthur Rams. They were in NPL. It was State League at the time.
Yeah.
And I got a no from the coach. I was like, what do you mean? A no. I've never been rejected at a trial, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, what is going on? I said, oh, good. No worries. I went back, played park soccer for another year. Yeah. The next year, I went back to Macarthur Rams and trialled again. And Raul Blanco was the coach at the time.
Yeah.
And he signed me.
Well, awesome.
One year difference makes, I was State League Goalkeeper of the Year.
Wow.
So from the year before them saying no, I went back, tried again, and I was the best keeper in the league.
So did you get anyone coming offering you? Where were we at that point? Was that between NSL and A-League, or what
was that was sort of between. I think A-League had already started because that was 2010.
Oh right. So no one came knocking the.
Not at that time. That year. When I was at Macarthur Rams, we played Sydney FC in a trial game.
Yeah.
I had a blinder. I think it finished 1-1, or we lost 1-0. I can't remember. I copped the goal in the last minute, but I had a blinder. Yes. And I think the coach at the time, I think he was one of those, the German coaches that Sydney FC had back at the start.
Yeah.
And he really liked me, but sort of nothing really eventuated out of that. So the year after, I went to Parramatta Melita. Was number one. And then out of nowhere, they brought back their old goalkeeper. He didn't make it in Spain, so they signed him. And I got dropped, you know. So I sort of had a tough year then. And the year after, they wanted to keep me at Parramatta. The other keeper was moving on. I said, well, as long as it's, you know, I don't get shafted like I did the year before, like I'm all good for fighting for your spot and, you know, best keeper plays, but it wasn't like that. So I was named club captain the next year. And funnily enough, my favourite number was number 23. And I asked the coach, before the season started, do you mind if I wear number 23? Like, you can wear whatever number you want. You're the captain, you wear whatever. I said, oh, thank you. Come season launch, we get our jerseys presented to us. He comes up to me, number 23, huh? I said, yeah, thank you. He goes, looks like I have to find myself a number one. I was like, wow. Oh, really? So, played round one.
Yeah.
I have a good game. We lose 1-0 to Sydney United. The next week, at training, everything's all good. Come weekend, I look at the team sheet, I'm on the bench. He's brought in a keeper, hasn't even trained with us.
Wow.
I didn't play another minute.
What?
And when the transfer window came across, the Sydney United keeper went to Sydney FC in the A-League. So yeah. Sydney United wanted to sign me. The coach said to me, you're not going anywhere. You're going to sit on the bench for the rest of the year, not playing another minute. And I'm not releasing you.
Because you chose number 23.
I don't know what the reasoning was behind it, but I went from club captain to not playing another minute. I ended up having meetings with the club and I ended up getting my release. The first game that I'm signed for Sydney United is against Parramatta. I'm not allowed to play. They won't let me play. They put a clause in that I can't play against them. So whatever. I play the next game. Have a blinder against Sydney Olympic. Week after, against Blacktown, worst injury of my life. I go for a high ball and I land on the post, snap every ligament in my left ankle. Gone. So I stayed at the club for the rest of the season, couldn't play, and then I go, that's it, I'm done. I can't even walk. So I was out for about 18 months. And then the next part of my journey starts.
Is there still part of you that thinks, what if?
Always.
Yeah.
Always. I'll always think, what if? Because I was at the top.
Yeah.
You can go speak to Jim Fraser. He'll tell you it was me and Danny Vukovic. It's all what ifs.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess that's part of what lit a fire under you for the Top Flight Goalkeeping Academy.
Well, it is, because I didn't have guidance from people that should have been there to help me. I had some great coaches, but I didn't have a great mentor that, in a situation when it's tough, tell me what to do or to go to for advice, So for me and my academy and my keepers, I'm all about them, their development, helping them reach the highest level they can. So that's why I think I've been so successful. My academy's only been around for a year. And I've got about 75 keepers.
Yeah, wow. So good.
Yeah.
What you described there is exactly what I talk about when we talk about purpose, and that's where you get success, because it's when you're able to deliver to people something that you didn't have and needed. Not only does it give you this sense of purpose, but just a sense of something bigger than you to be able to give that and pay that forward. But it means that those people on the receiving end are getting everything that they need, because you know what that path is like without it. So I'm not surprised on the growth, and I know, having spoken to you, already do this, but for the listeners, describe a little bit about what you do in terms of mentoring these young men and women too, I imagine. Yeah,
I've got a couple young girls that are at the academy.
Yeah, so what do you teach them beyond just pure goalkeeping? What are some of those things that you teach them around mindset? And some of those messages that you just said you didn't get, but you know that they need from that young age.
So for me, the biggest thing is respect. you've got to respect the people around you. You've got to respect your parents, your coaches, your teammates, referees, your teachers at school. You know, that's number one. Without respect in life, you're not going to get respected by anyone. Yeah. Secondly, discipline, commitment, you know, and it's about making them believe in themselves. A lot of these kids, yeah, your parents are always going to say, oh yeah, my son or my daughter, they're great. You're going to come across coaches that think they know the game, but they don't. Not all coaches know goalkeeping, you know. So, yeah, they get blamed for a goal where the coach thinks it's their fault and the head drops. Instead of lifting that player up and saying, what could you have done better? Asking them to figure out on their own what they could have done better in that situation and then guiding them and helping them believe that they can be better and they can do whatever they put their minds to. In the end, if they don't have confidence in themselves, if they don't have belief and they don't feel the belief from me as a coach, they're not going to be able to believe in themselves.
Love it. Powerful, mate. I imagine that's something you've had to learn, one, from those setbacks in football, but two, like you said, you come out the back of going through a pretty traumatic health experience where you kind of felt like, well, I didn't want to do anything, like having to recapture that belief. You must have learned a lot about yourself in both of those scenarios.
Yeah, it's all character building. You know, I know even to today, one thing that I believe that since my stroke is my memory goes a little bit. And I might be doing something and I'll forget why I'm doing it. You know, and that's a little bit scary. You know, so I tend to now write things down just in case I forget. But okay. It's everything we go through in life builds character.
Yeah.
You know, weakness is just the mindset. If you, you know, don't believe that you can do something or you believe something is too hard, that's all in your mind. Your mind will give up before your body does. You know, and I tend to tell that to my players because for me, my keepers have to be fitter than players. You know, they have to be able to push and you have to be a different beast to stand in between those two poles.
Yeah. Yeah? You're all got a couple of screws loose, so I reckon.
Well, that's what they say. But it's a different game. You know, so you've got to be ruthless. You've got to believe that, you know. I listened to a podcast with Kasper Schmeichel, and he says a goalkeeper has to have a cloak of invincibility and believe that no matter what, it's not your fault. You know? No matter what has just happened, you can't change that. You have to keep moving forward. Yeah, if you let a mistake define the rest of your game, you're not going to be a winner. So yeah. I believe that's something that stood with me since I heard that. Very powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that I'm getting from your story and something that's in your bio, talking about how you were fearless on the field and what you've described you've been through certainly would have taken a huge amount of courage. So how important is that when you're instilling in these young keepers the importance of fearlessness and courage, because from what you've described and what I know, like trying to save from point blank sometimes, especially at training from like your own teammates at times, like that's something that I could never comprehend. I remember like in a park game going in goals when, you know, everyone switches position and a ball coming from close range and it was in the back of the net before I'd even reacted. Like it's a completely different thing to anything else on the field, obviously.
But. So you've played the game and if you've ever had a goalkeeper behind you that's fearless, does that make you more confident?
Oh, 100%.
Knowing that he's going to come and collect anything that comes towards that goal.
And as a striker, when you're playing against a keeper like that, you have some fear because you're thinking,
if I'm just watching
it's massively intimidating, especially if it's a big frame and they know how to use it. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's something that I was very big on when I was playing. I attack every ball and I never back out. Yeah, and now when I coach kids, especially at the start, they tend to sort of still be scared of that ball.
Yeah.
So it's trying to get that fear out of them that the ball's not going to actually hurt you. Yeah, if you have a positive body shape and a presence, and you're nice and strong, the ball doesn't hurt. Yeah, don't back out of any challenge. If you're going to go, you go. I found a lot of my keepers, the improvement that I've seen over the last 12 months, I can't believe it myself, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and to me, whenever you're coaching someone in no matter what capacity, there's always those moments where you pass on what you know, but then they take it to a whole other level. And I still get those moments where I'm just blown away. Like that's part of the magic of guiding other people, right?
Yeah, that's right. Like when I get messages or I see Instagram posts, you know, of my young keepers in there, like can't wait for next top flight goalkeeper session because it's the best day of my week.
How good.
It's rewarding, you know, and it's not for me. And like I say to parents when they message me and they tell me, thanks to you, it's not thanks to me. I'm just here to guide them. They're the ones that are putting in the effort.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah. I love that. I love that. And that's definitely a message that I pass on to people I'm coaching, like even, you know, adults 50 plus. Like, yeah, it's the same conversation. Like, it's like, no, you had to go and do it. Like, I can only guide you. Some will, some won't. But it's the presence and, yeah, go on.
That's 100% the truth. You know yourself and I know as coaches, we're just guiding and mentoring and sort of showing them the path. They have to go down that path and do all the work.
100%. Can you share a bit of gold on how you then map that fearlessness and courage across across to like everyday life? Like how do you then take that same mentality into every other area of your life so that you can then tackle different challenges with that same determination?
I think it's the people around you that, you know, when you have young kids, you can't show that you're fearful of something. So I try and instill that into my kids is you're going to be okay. You know, don't be scared. Just attempt it. Show up. Do it. If it doesn't work and you fail, that's okay too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's going to fail. No one's perfect. So I believe that's why I can be fearless, because I know it's okay to fail. You can fail 8, 9, 10 times, but if you keep trying, eventually you're going to get that desired outcome that you're after.
Yeah. And it's getting a bit cliched, but it's still so true. I was only reading an email from a coach that I follow this morning, and that's what they talked about. The reason for my success is because I muck things up all the time. 9 out of 10 things that I try, because she works in a creative space, 9 out of 10 things that I try just fall completely flat. But it's because I just keep relentlessly pushing forward, coming up with more, tackling new things. That's how you get success.
Well, that's how I look at my sessions, right? My sessions are all very high intense. It doesn't matter how young you are. You need to learn from that age that high intensity and high work rate is what's going to help you get better. Now, I do a lot of self-reflection, especially when it comes to my coaching.
Yeah.
And sometimes certain exercises that I do or certain sessions that I plan, in my head, they work out better than what they actually do. And I leave the session and I'm like, I wasn't happy with myself, you know. And then you're always trying to work out a way to tweak things to make them better. And I think that's the key.
Yeah.
Everyone can always be better at what they're doing. You just got to continue to tweak and tweak and tweak. You're never going to be perfect, but you want to try and get as close to perfect as possible.
Yeah, well said. Another thing I noticed, and I've also witnessed from you, Tommy, is in your bio it says you're known for your vocal leadership, but I also know that when we've done those sessions with the other coaches at King's, you've been one of the few people who put your hand up and share and confidently speak up when maybe some of them are thinking they might but don't always. So is that vocal leadership something that's come naturally from a young age? Is it something you picked up from your parents? Like, talk to us a bit about that.
Believe it or not, for me, that's my weak point, speaking in front of people.
Yeah.
But when I get into a situation, for example, on a football pitch, I've got no issues. That's my comfort zone. But when I get up, like the things we've done at King's, that's hard. When I have to go and speak in front of people, that's hard. But if I know I have to do it, I know I've got good things to say. So I just do it.
You force yourself.
If you don't, you have to. Yeah. Sometimes you have to put yourself in that position where you're not in your comfort zone. And that's when you can really step up and show your character.
100%. And it's the reason why I sought you out afterwards to chat, because of that. Like, it's leadership, but it also shows there's something about you that really draws people to you. And I think for anyone listening, no matter what age they're up to, or if they're thinking about their young athletes that they're either coach or that they're parents to, is that it's such an important skill. And what I want to also ask you is, like, I've noticed in a lot of other codes, they talk about some of the young sports people coming through, they tend to be really quiet. Is that something you've experienced with the guys that you coach? And if so, how do you sort of bring them out of that comfort zone when they're coming through?
I honestly think that's a generational issue.
Yeah.
Because most kids now, since I've come back into the game, it's very different. It's not like how it used to be. Mm. You know, so they are very quiet and they're not as out there and vocal. You don't get leaders like they used to be.
Interesting.
You know, and for me, the way I try and bring that out of them is, one, I give them belief in themselves. Two, at training, you have a joke with them. Get them feeling comfortable, and then they start. Then they start talking and being vocal and being confident within themselves. Yeah, and I think that's important. I think a lot of kids now are stuck in a shell and so worried about, oh, what's this person going to think if I say this,
mm-hmm.
you know? But that has to come out.
It has to. That was me as a teen as well. And I was blessed to have a coach that really brought that out in me. Do you work with the parents on that and then talk to them about the need for it, but also some strategies around how they're going to bring their young athlete out of their shell?
I speak to a lot of parents and I do have these conversations, and it is actually something that I want to put together, with them, is sort of a night where we sit down all together, the parents and the athletes, and talk about how we can improve that confidence at home, not just at football, at home, at school, and get them out of that shell. You know, I understand, because I was always that kid that was scared to talk in front of people. As soon as I have to talk in front of people, I start stuttering, and it's intimidating. They say, "Oh, picture everyone naked," but you can't do that.
No, that doesn't work.
I've tried.
Oh man, so good. I wanted to ask you about your family. Like we talked about the Croatian heritage.
Yep.
That tight family unit, how important was for you growing up? Just life in general, but also from that football journey. I'm sure that was a family thing as well, going to football, whether it was playing or watching.
Yeah, it was. My dad was always my biggest supporter. You know, no matter what, he always believed that I was the best, and it made me believe that. And I was, maybe I wasn't the best, but I was up there. So even when I was hitting 33, when I was planning to retire, he was so upset. And unfortunately, my dad passed away on New Year's Eve, just passed.
Yeah, wow.
And for me, I had to go and get my keepers. So we're training on New Year's Day. We're training.
Wow.
That was my outlet, because I know my dad would be proud of what I've achieved in such a short period of time. I only briefly spoke to him because he lived overseas. I spoke to him every day, but I started the academy in September. I didn't speak to him for the last month that he was alive, because he was in hospital.
Yeah, right.
And so he only sort of briefly saw what I was doing through social media. And then I've really focused on, my goal was always to have the best goalkeepers come out of Top Flight, hence the name Top Flight. So I'm really proud of what I've built in this short period of time, but sky's the limit. I'm always looking at ways to make it better. I've got a goalkeeper tour in the UK next year.
Awesome.
where we've got three sessions with Man City Academy, one with Liverpool, one with Chelsea, one with Tottenham, one with Wolverhampton. It's something that hasn't been done in terms of goalkeeper space. So it's not only the experience for them to go to these clubs and train at these amazing facilities. It's a learning experience for myself to see what they do over there, so I can bring back here and help develop more goalkeepers to maybe one day sign that professional contract.
Oh yeah, and imagine building a relationship with these clubs where you're creating a funnel for these. Yeah.
Well, that's the plan. Awesome. There's There's always a method to my madness, as I tell my keepers. Everything I do is for a reason. So,
oh man, goosebumps all through that, mate. I think, like, you know what you said before, like there's a gap in the market around goalkeepers in Australia, and you're already starting to fill that, and to be able to create that pipeline, mate. That, mate, magic. I know that's something that I've experienced losing my dad as well, and I know it left a massive hole. What's something that you've struggled to reconcile since he's passed?
I think just the, I never got closure. I never got to say goodbye. I never got to go to his funeral. Because over there, they do it within a day or two of them passing is the funeral.
Yeah,
right. So one, being at New Year's Eve, I got a phone call at 10 p.m.
Yeah,
I wouldn't even get there on time. So for me, that was, even to this day, that's the hardest part for me, is I didn't get to say goodbye to my dad.
Yeah, so tough. And we'll have a talk about that once we jump off. But I'd love to hear, like, something that you really know that that you learned from your dad that you still use every day, and that's something that you're able to pass on, like a legacy to the next generation.
I think the one thing that he instilled in me is to always have that self-belief. And, I mean, if you don't believe in yourself, how do you expect someone else to believe in you?
Yeah, 100%.
So, yeah.
That's good, mate. I love what you're creating, Tommy. I love what you've created. I love how quickly it's grown, and I love what the future holds in terms of the opportunities that you're creating for young Australian goalkeepers. Thank you for coming on and telling your story. I know some of that stuff's pretty raw.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, man. I appreciate you sharing some of the wisdom for the listeners as coaches and parents, but also what you've shared just in terms of being someone that's been through a high performance environment, but also just an everyday person with a family, and what you can learn and take forward into all areas of life, mate. I really appreciate it, and I commend you for sharing so openly. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So what were the big lessons from today's conversation with Tommy Romage? Respect is the foundation for success in football and in life. Discipline, commitment, and courage build resilience when the pressure is on. Vocal leadership and self-belief aren't just skills for sport, they shape who you are everywhere. And passing on knowledge to the next generation is one of the most powerful legacies you can leave. And if you're ready to not just learn these lessons, but actually live them, my game plan training is designed to help you do exactly that, giving you the tools and structure to back yourself, build confidence, and create a life you're proud of on and off the field. Check out the link in the show notes to get started. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sport is Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.